have had. That is the key, Fedra no Delone. She took care with my name, saying it slow, then smiled. Though you are almost, almost worth a war. I dragged myself up to sit cross-legged, raking my hands through my hair. Melisande's diamond hung about my throat, the only thing to adorn me. "Did you do it for that?" I asked. "No," Gronya smiled again, clapping her hands and summoning Brennan to her. He clung to her waist and grinned up at his mother. "For me." She tousled his hair and gave me a considering look. "Do you think your ship captain would breed strong sons and daughters?" "Quintilius Rouse," I laughed, then caught myself. "Yes, my lady, that I do." "Good." Her grey-green eyes glinted in the sunlight. "Tomorrow we may die, so it is best to live today. And some things are best decided in haste. Maybe you can teach my brother as much. If you can find the balance between them." "It seems," I said, "I will have to try." Chapter 71. Mercifully, I was not the only one suffering the after-effects of Ishka that day. Most of the Dangelines were bleary-eyed, and no few of the Dauriada. Not all, it seemed, had Gronya's constitution. Even some of the Kruinya nursed aching heads, although Drustin was not among them. None of them, however, had to face Jocelyn Verai's glare of disapproval. "It is a disgrace," he hissed at me as we sat to break our fast. "Do you think every problem can be solved by falling into someone's bed? Do you think it's for that, that Isandre de la Courcelle chose you?" "Forgive me," I muttered sourly, propping my head in my hands. "I've not your skill with a sword to resolve matters that way. Anyway, I might not have fallen there if you hadn't left me, all of you. Mayhap you should try it. It might improve your mood."
"I have never," he began grimly.
I looked at him.
"That was different," he said it quietly.
"Yes," I rubbed my aching temples, "it was. And this was what happens when you send a servant of Nama to do a diplomat's job and ply her with strong drink." Jocelyn drew breath to speak, then looked at my miserable state. A muscle in his cheek twitched that might have been a repressed smile.
"At least you had the choosing of it, or so I hear."
"Oh, I chose, all right." He glanced at Gronya, laughing at the head of the table and eating with good appetite, tearing bread from a loaf.
"She does have a certain barbarian splendor."
I laughed, then stopped. It hurt my head. By noon I had recovered enough to accept Drustin's invitation to tour the Dauriada settlement, which was called Innisclan. We went on horseback, the Pictish prince and four of his crewinya, Jocelyn and I. He pointed out the holdings, the smithy and the mill, the vast cattle herds of the Dauriada that spread across the land, grazing on the bright spring grass. A peaceful scene, but the moist warmth in the air made my blood run cold. The season was hastening on, each day that fleeted past bringing us closer to summer and war. "Where lies your home, my lord?" I asked Drustin.
"There."
Turning his horse, he pointed unerringly to the southeast. Like all exiles, he carried within him a map that ever marked the way homeward.
"Bryn Garadam, where Maelcon sits upon my throne."
He bared his teeth in a white snarl, frightful in his blue-marked face.
"I will mount his head above my door."
Eloah helped me. I could only pray he did. "Will Aemon accede, do you think?" I asked him. Drustin shook his head, losing his fearsome expression.
"There is no fiercer fighter when he is cornered, but Aemon does not ride into danger. If Maelcon ever came for me, Aemon would fight until his dying breath. But his nature is to defend, not attack."
"If Gronya chose against him, would the Dauriada follow?" He gave me a speculative look.
"Some of them would, yes, Your warrior's skill has fired their hearts. He inclined his head to Jocelyn, who smiled politely, not understanding. But Grania will not do this. Bold as an eagle she may be, but even she cannot cut the bond between them. Resting his reins on the pommel of his saddle, he looked back to the east, homeward and beyond, to the distant shores of Terre d'Ange, and his voice changed. I dreamed of a bond once. Two kingdoms, side by side, in open and free alliance. Two thrones, bound with the silken thread of love, and not the chains of necessity. He smiled a little. So we said, in my very bad Kerdiki, but I have not voiced even to you, and her Cruinia, which was little better. But we understood one another. That is what we dreamed, Isarde de la Courcelle and I. Does she still? I had not, I think, understood what Isandra had told me. She had spoken of it indirectly, couching the meaning in the words of politics. I understood then. She loved him, with all the wayward fervor of the 16-year-old girl she'd been when they met. And he felt the same. Yes, my lord, I whispered. She does. His dark eyes returned to mine, dwelling on my face. Earth's oldest children, his sister had said. Perhaps, after all, he was not such an unfit match for the Queen of Terre d'Ange. I will wait a week, dressed in Mab Nectina said calmly, for Aemon to decide. Then, if his heart is unchanged, I will leave, and take up the banner of the Culloch Gorum, to march upon Bryn Gorridum. There are those who will follow, though not enough, I think, without the Dalriada. You will take your ship and return to Terre d'Ange. Tell Isandra I will come, if I live. There was naught to say. I bowed my head. Justin turned his horse, calling his men, and we set out for the hall of Innisclan. I translated our conversation for Jocelyn as we rode. I am going to do somewhat else, I said then, that you will not like. Just abide it and hold your tongue. I swear to you on Delaunay's name, I've a reason for it. For 3 days we met and talked. Word of our arrival had spread, and Dalriada clan lords appeared daily in Innisclan, until the hall could scarce hold them. Tall and fierce, all of them, in many-coloured woolens and the fine ornate goldwork on which they pride themselves. Some came ready for war, hair stiffened into white crests with lime. Rouse had spoken of it, but it was the first I'd seen. But the twins were the lords of the Dalriada, and while Aemon held out, there would be no war. And that he did. Not alone, either, for there were those among the Dalriada who'd no will to risk war for the Cruinia's sake.
A fool's errand, and one were like to return from empty-handed, Quintilius Rouse said grimly, observing the proceedings.
I'd spoken that day until my mouth was dry, and my mind a tangled knot of words. D'Angeline and Cruinia coiled like a serpent's nest. Aemon listened and watched me with hot eyes, caring nothing for what I said. I am no orator to sway men's hearts with words. My skills lie elsewhere.
We've 4 days yet.
I pressed the heels of my hands to my eyes, fighting exhaustion. 3 days of politely declining Aemon's unsubtle interest, pretending not to notice. I couldn't even count the other offers. I dropped my hands and grinned at Rouse.
Are you so quick to leave the Lady Grania's bed?
He blushed all over his scarred face, muttering,
Wants to get a child.
I know. She thinks you're good stock. She's very direct in her desires. Actually, they were rather well matched, but I thought it privately.
Speil had a dream, Hyacinth announced, referring to Nectina's middle daughter. She saw you, Fedra. You were holding a scale, tipped all to one side.
You understood this? I raised my brows at him. He looked at me nonplussed.
They are teaching me Cruinia, and I am teaching them about the Dromond. You have been busy elsewhere, doing the Queen's business.
Yes, well, tell your dreamers that the scale is not yet ready to balance, I said wryly. Do they see you as well in their dreams, O Prince of Travellers?
Hyacinth shook his head, frowning slightly. "Only once. Breather dreamed me on an island and asked if I was born there. Not else."
"Passing strange," I said, forgetting about it in the next instant, as Drustin beckoned me to spin tales of the glories of a Dangeline alliance for an eager-looking Dalriada clanlord. We'd done a good job of that, at least. I made my way across the hall, feeling Aemon's gaze at my back. So it had been, ever since I'd bedded his sister. But I'd spoken true to Hyacinth. If I was no diplomat, still I knew to gauge a patron. Aemon was a slow man, as cautious and deliberate as his sister was impetuous. He'd cast his luck and lost the first night. He'd be wary of approaching the brink, and I needed him to be desperate. 4 days, and then 5. Gronya and Aemon had shouting matches, backed by their factions. I saw the first quarrel between Dalriada and Cruinia when one of Drustin's men was set upon by 3 outlander Dalriada, and I saw then why Aemon had declined to test Drustin's steel. Outnumbered and outsized, the Cruinia warrior fought with a cunning and speed I'd never witnessed, holding his own until Drustin came at a run, half-gated and furious, shoving Dalriada's swords aside with his bare hands. They could have killed him then. They didn't, looking with fear and respect at his blue warrior's marks, the red cloak and the gold torque of his birthright. The Cruach of Alba. "Tell them tomorrow," I said to him when the Dalriada had apologized and gone. "Not in council, but after, when they're feasting in the hall. Tell them what you have decided." He looked at me and nodded.
"I will do as you wish."
So it was that it happened on the 6th day. As on the others, nothing was decided, the twins at odds. Still they honored the laws of hospitality, fating their guests. It was in the hall, before the roaring fire, that Drustin rose to address Gronya and Aemon.
"My lords of the Dalriada," he said, bowing, "you have given shelter to me and my people, and I am ever grateful. But I have sworn a pledge."
He held up his right hand, firelight gleaming from the gold of Roland's signet.
"I must honor it, or die trying. A usurper sits upon my uncle's throne, mine by right, my father's slaying cousin Malecorn. On the morrow I ride east to reclaim that which is mine, and if I live we cross the streets."
Pandemonium erupted in the hall, noisy and familiar. I waited, then made my way to the twins' thrones. "My lords," I said, kneeling, "we thank you for your hospitality. Prince Drustin has spoken. We will depart on the morrow, carrying his words to our queen."
Gronya gave me a regal nod and turned away, concealing an amused glint in her grey-green eyes. She knew what I was about to try. She'd given me the key. I stood and made my curtsy, with all the grace of Sirius House, and turned to leave.
"Wait," Aemon protested, following to catch my shoulder. "You need not depart in such haste, my lady. At least drink with me, will you not? You have not, you cannot."
He shot an evil glance at his sister.
"We are alike, she and I, born of one womb. You cannot favour one over the other."
"My lord," I shook off his hand, "I am the queen's ambassador. Would you treat me so?"
"I have never forced any woman." Snatching his hand back, he glared at me. "But how can you choose so? It is not right."
I shrugged. "My lord," I said mildly, "as you desire Dangeline's for our beauty, so do we admire aught in others, boldness and daring. Such your sister possesses."
"And you say I do not?"
Aemon was working himself into a fury, features wild and distorted.
"You say I lack courage?"
A small crowd was beginning to gather. Jocelyn worked through it unobtrusively, making his way to my side. Feeling his reassuring presence at my shoulder, I looked at Aemon and shrugged again, keeping my face expressionless.
"I do not say it, my lord. Your actions speak for me."
"Rather louder than you imagined, Aemon."
That was Gronya's voice, sharp and mocking. It drew laughter.
He turned to glare at her, his face near purple with anger, hands fisting at his sides. She looked back at him, her face a cool reflection of his, red-gold brows arched.
"You have made your bed. Do you cry now that you lie in it alone?"
"If it is daring you want," he said through grinding teeth, "I will show you daring."
Thrusting one fist into the air, he cried out, "The Dalriada ride to war, at the side of Drustan Mab Nectina."
Cheers erupted. If there were groans, they were swept aside in the wave of jubilation. Aemon pumped his fist, shouting, wholly caught up in it. For a moment, I think, he forgot about me. I had been a catalyst to this deep rivalry between the twins, no more. But he remembered, and turned to me with bright eyes, grinning.
"What do you say to that, D'Angeline?" he asked, catching my arms. "Was that daring enough?"
A horse, a sword, a brooch. It was a boy's glee, at a victory won. It made me smile despite myself. "Yes, my lord," I said, meaning it. "It is enough." At my side, Jocelyn heaved a sigh. Thus did it come to pass that I bedded the twins, lords of the Dalriada. Aemon kept his grin for days, going about the business of preparing for war with it plastered on his face, foolish and blissful. I dare say I served him better than I had his sister, having been considerably more sober. Although Gronya had no complaints, to be sure, she caught me in the hall one day and slid a gold bracelet over my arm, rich with the fine, intricate knotwork they do. "For luck," she said, amused. "This goddess you serve, she is a powerful one." I hoped so. We were riding to war.
Chapter 72. No D'Angeline need march, of course. It was not our battle. We could have set sail, gone the long way around, avoiding the straits, to set course for Lower Siobhal. But it would have been a coward's course, and in truth we'd have had no word to bear. By the time we made landfall and won through to Isandre, the Cruinia would have crossed the straits or died. Drustan was willing to ride to the heir of Terre d'Ange. We D'Angelines could do no less for the Culloch Gorim. Quintilius Rouse left half his men with the ship, with instructions to bring word to the Queen if we failed. The rest of us would follow the battle. The Dalriada ride to war as if to a party, laughing and shouting and jesting, decked out in splendour and finery. The lords fight in the old style still, with war chariots. It was something to behold, a Hellene tale sprung to life. The Cruinia are quieter, but just as deadly, fierce eyes and battle grins gleaming in their blue world faces. 20 warriors, Dalriada and Cruinia, paired in twos, rode in advance of the swiftest horses, leaving at angles in a vast semicircle to compass Alba. They carried the twin banners under which they fought, the Falair Born, the White Mare of Era, white on a green field, and the Culloch Gorim, the Black Boar, on a field of scarlet. We cheered as they left, twisting in the saddle to wave bold farewells, knowing themselves most likely to die. If they succeeded, they would spread word, bringing allies to swell our ranks as we marched eastward. Some would succeed, some would die. Drustan watched them go in silence. 50 men, no more, had come with him to Innisclan, fighting free of Maelcon's forces, protecting the Cruach's heir, his mother and sisters. A full 200 had begun the journey. His blood father had been among them, slain at the hands of the Tarav Crow. Melkon's mother, Fochleda, was of the Briganti, who followed the Red Bull. It was her kin who came, overrunning Bryn Gorodom, starting the bloodbath, setting Melkon on the throne. No wonder, I thought, the Lioness of Azal had sought to treat with Fochleda and Maelcon. They would have understood one another. I wondered about Marc de Trevelyan then, and whether he'd been recalled from exile, whether or not his daughter Bernadette was willing to marry Guilain de Somerville, whether or not Marc agreed. I wondered whether or not war was declared if d'Eglamour was at large, and about the deadly vipers of House Charizai. I wondered, indeed, if Isandre still held the throne. Who was to say, I wondered, if the royal house of Aragon had sent troops, and how many? I wondered what Voldemar Selig knew. It was a terrible thing to be so far and know so little, but I could not help wondering. I rode with Hyacinth and Jocelyn, Nectina and her daughters, and others of the twins' household, behind the advancing army. We'd have choked on their dust in a Dongeline summer, but it was late spring in Alba, and a rain fell nearly every day, damping the dust and greening the earth. A full mile wide, our front line stretched, straggling and undisciplined, travelling at the foot-soldiers' pace. We marched and marched and ate what we could, the army foraging while the peasants cursed. Drustin's Cruinia shot for the pot, their arrows finding game with deadly accuracy. None of his folk ever went hungry. And the allies came, flocking to the banner of Culloch Gorham. Handfuls of Decarnity and Corvanaki, Ordovals and Dumoni, flying the black boar, and our numbers grew. And then a wild band of Sigilve and Votarde from the north, defiantly waving the red bull. Fair-haired, with height, and lime-crested manes like the Dalriada, and the blue masks of the Cruinia. And bad news, too, of tribes among the Tariff Crow, loyal to Melkon, and six of Drustin's outriders slain. Melkon knew. Melkon was raising an army. Melkon was waiting. A rumor reached us. The south had declared for Melkon, and was rising up to burn the homesteads of those to the north who'd left to follow the Culloch Gorham. We nearly had a mutiny then, as half the tribes of the Culloch Gorham bid to turn back, until we saw a large force on the horizon. The twins were ready to attack. It was Drustin made them wait, holding desperately in place, until he saw who approached. Trinovanti, Archibati, Kantike, folk of the Iglach Orr, flying the Golden Hind on green, and above it the Black Boar, declaring their allegiance. It was a false rumour. Battle they'd seen, and lost hundreds of warriors, but Melkon's supporters had given way to those who remembered their ancient blood debt to Cynal Rhu's line. So we made our way toward Bryn Gorodom.
"Boys, amazing!" Quintilius Rouse said, settling by our fire with a grunt.
He'd a pain in his joints that troubled him in damp weather.
"He never sleeps. Melkon's army's out there, Eloa knows where, and he's riding up and down the lines, a word for every man among 'em, and the women, too. What kind of damn fool people let their women ride to war?"
"Would you try to stop them?" I asked, thinking of Gronya. Rouse gave me a dour look.
"I would if I wedded one," he said sourly. "Listen, I've been thinking. Mayhap it would be for the best if I brought the lads in, had them guard you, my lady. When the battle breaks, you shouldn't be without protection."
Speil, Nectina's middle daughter, spoke. Quintilius Rouse looked at me. I translated. "If you will not die for us," I said slowly, "you cannot ask us to die for you."
"I don't want anyone to die,"
Quintilius Rouse said, scowling at her, waiting for me to translate. Little need, though, she seemed to have of it.
"But least of all, my Lady Queen's ambassador."
I wrapped my arms around my knees and gazed at the night sky, stars hidden under a blanket of cloud. "My Lord Admiral," I said, "if you are asking me for the sake of your men, I say yes, let them do this thing, for I've no wish to see Dangeline bloodshed on foreign soil, nor to bring word of your death to Isandre de la Courcelle. But if you are asking for my sake, I say no." I looked at him. "I cannot countenance it. Not with what we are asking of them." He cursed me then with a sailor's fluency. Delaunay's name was repeated no few times, with several choice comments about honour and idiocy. I waited him out. "We will be well behind the lines of battle, my Lord Admiral," I said. "I take no risk that the prince's own mother does not share, and I have Jocelyn." Quintilius Rouse cursed some more,
got up and paced, stabbing one thick finger at Jocelyn.
"You will stay with her?" he asked, brows bristling. "You swear it, Carceline? You will never leave her side?"
Jocelyn bowed, his vambraces flashing in the firelight.
"I have sworn it, my lord,"
he said softly, "to damnation and beyond."
"I ask it for your sake."
Quintilius Rouse fetched up in front of me and drew a ragged breath.
"My men are itching to fight Albans. They've seen no action since we fought the Hellions of Kebeli Makard. But I swear to you, Fedrano Delaunay, if harm comes to you in this battle, your lord's shade will plague me until my dying, and I've no wish to have it on my head."
"She will not die." It was Hyacinth's voice, hollow with the Dromond. He turned his head, black gaze meeting Rouse's, blurred and strange with sight.
"Her long road is not ended, nor yours, Admiral." "Do you say we will be victorious?"
Rouse's voice took on a jesting edge. Hyacinth's gift made him uneasy, the more so since it had proved true.
"Do you say so, Tsingano?"
Hyacinth shook his head, black ringlets swinging.
"I see you returning to water, my lord, and Fedra as well. More I cannot see."
Quintilius Rouse cursed again, at greater length.
"So be it. We'll fight for Isandra's blue lab, then. Let Alban blood taste Dangeline's steel."
He bowed to me, his scarred features suffused with irony.
"May Eloa bless you, my lady, and your Tsingano witch-boy, and Carceline, what's it, protect you. We will meet again on the water, or in the true Terdange that lies beyond."
"Blessed Eloa be with you," I murmured, kneeling and rising. I embraced him and kissed his scarred cheek. "No queen nor king e'er had a truer servant, my lord Quintilius Rouse." He blushed. I could feel the heat of it beneath my lips.
"Nor a stranger ambassador," he said gruffly, embracing me. "No better girl. You've brought him here, haven't you? Eloa be with you."
We slept that night under the clouded skies, while the camp stirred, sentries startled at the slightest noise, and Cruinia scouts prowled the perimeter, searching for Maelcon's army. We were less than a day's march from Bryn Garadum. No word had come when the crepuscular light that heralded dawn swept over Alba, but Drustin roused the army all the same. They turned out in a formless horde, some 6,000 foot, 700 horse, and 50 chariots or more. We were encamped at the verge of a young copse, alongside a deep valley. Beyond the valley, it was straight onward to Bryn Garadum. Drustin sat his brown horse with a straight back, his head high, the scarlet cloak flowing over its haunches. He rode slowly back and forth, letting the army see him, letting them know he would not hide his identity from Maelcon's forces.
"Brothers and sisters," he cried, "you know why we are here. We come to restore the throne of Alba to its rightful heir. We come to seize it from the hands of Maelcon the Usurper, whose hands are red with his own father's blood."
They cheered, hoisting spears, rattling swords against their bucklers. The Dalriada, I think, cheered loudest of all. Aemon and Gronia led their folk, wore chariots side by side, as if awaiting the start of a race, their teams baring teeth and snapping at one another.
"I am Drustin Mab Nectana, and you know my line and my kin. But I tell you now, all who stand here with me today, you are my kin, and I name you brother and sister each one. When the sun breaks over the trees..."
A hush spread through the army, men and women falling silent one by one. We had climbed onto a narrow outcrop behind the lines, those of us not fighting, but Drustin's kin had the place of honour at the highest part. I could see well enough to make him out over the crush of warriors, but not beyond. It was his sister Breather who let out a cry and pointed. We crowded to her side, all of us, and looked.
There, at the edge of the copse, where the young beech trees were leafing golden and a thin mist rose from the warm, moist ground, a black boar emerged. It was enormous. How long boars live, I do not know, but this one must have been ancient to have grown to such a size. Its bulk loomed against the slender trees. It raised its black snout, scenting the air. Its tusks could have harrowed a field. Someone made a faint sound of disbelief, and I recognized my own voice. I swear I could smell its rank odor on the morning mist. The black boar glared through the gray dawn with small, fiery eyes. 6,000 and some Pictish and Aran warriors stared back at it in awe-stricken silence. A shout arose, a single choked shout. The mighty boar wheeled with a fearful grunt, heading back into the copse. It ran half-gated and lame. Almost 7,000 throats giving voice to a single cry. Drustin Mab Nectina's face, blue-marked and savage, his black eyes shining as he drew his sword, his fierce shout rising over the vast wave of the army's ululation.
"Follow the Kullock, Godam!"
With a fearful din, they charged. There was no discipline to it, no strategy, no plan. Drustin's army charged as they were assembled, a belligerent horde, foot soldiers outracing the horse as they reached the copse, the chariots wheeling, seeking broad enough passage. The beech woods full suddenly of howling soldiers, bursting onto the verge of the valley. What they found there, I know, for I heard it later. At the base of the valley, Mail Khan's army, that had crept stealthily through the night, hoping to surprise them at dawn. In another 10 minutes, they'd have done it, coming round to flank us on both sides. And Drustin had bid fair to speak for that long, if not for the black boar. Do not discount the Kullock Gorham. We heard the sound of it. Those of us left behind, a terrible clash of arms, death cries arising as steel beat upon steel. Trapped at the base of the valley, Mail Khan's men died as thousands of the followers of the Kullock Gorham poured down the green sides of the hill. And Mail Khan's men fought, desperate and caught, slaying hundreds as they died. Now I know. Then I did not. I looked at Hyacinth, saw his face blurred and terrified, sight-blind eyes turned toward the battle. "What do you see?" I asked, shaking him. "What do you see?"
"Death,"
he answered me in a whisper, turning his Dromond-stricken gaze upon me.
"Death!"
I looked at him and past him and saw something else. A party of the Tar of Crow, red-haired Cruinia and fair, faces tattooed blue, in well-worn arms and mounted under the standard of the Red Bull.
"Milkhorn was right," one said, drawing his sword and gesturing. They spread out to encircle us. "Take them hostage."
Not us, but Nectina. Nectina and her daughters, Drustin's mother and sisters, with whom we stood, all of us, trapped on our rocky vantage. They were Cruinia, the women. If they did not ride to battle, still they could shoot, as well as the men, and better. I'd seen it. But their bows lay at the campsite, only a few yards away, and between it and us stood Mail Khan's men. We were none of us armed. Except Jocelyn. Almost without thinking, I looked to him, knowing already what I would see. He was in motion, unhesitating, the morning sun reflecting bright steel as his daggers came free. His vambraces flashed like silver, and he picked a spot halfway down the outcropping and bowed.
"In Carsiel's name," he said softly, "I protect and serve."
And they attacked. Two fell, then three, then five. There were too many, and they swarmed the sides of the rock, dismounting, blades out and swinging. Hyacinth swore and scrabbled for stones, hurling them with a street fighter's accuracy. A small figure, dark and quick, slipped over the side of the outcrop. One of the Tar of Crow gained the summit and lunged at me, whirling his sword. I ducked and got behind him. I don't know how, and shoved. He stumbled back into his comrades, laughing.
"Jocelyn!"
I shouted. "Draw your sword!" He paused mid-battle, glancing at me. I saw it in his quick blue gaze, the memory of Scaldia, his oath betrayed. Then his face hardened, he rammed his daggers into their twin sheaths, and his sword rang free of its scabbard. A single lithe form slipped past Jocelyn, swift and darting. He started and caught himself, fighting like a dervish.
"Fall back!"
the leader of the Tariff Crow party cried in harsh Cruinia. They obeyed, retreating to their horse. He had guessed aright. Jocelyn, unwilling to give up the advantage of height, awaited on the rocks, his angled sword reflecting sunlight across their faces. That was when the arrows began to sing. It was Mairead who had gained the camp. Mairead, Nectna's youngest, a full quiver at hand, shooting grim and deadly, little more than a girl. Two of the Tariff Crow dropped before their leader, cursed and fumbled for the butt of his spear.
"Never mind hostages," he shouted. "Kill them all!"
With that, he cast his spear at Mairead. I saw it catch her, pierce her through the middle, both hands rising to circle the shaft, gasping as she fell backward, and I heard two cries, Hyacinth's broken-hearted, and a second cry, like the sound of dying, Nectina, hands covering her eyes, Mairead's sisters keened, low and grieving. One other shout, clarion, splitting the morning. I had seen Jocelyn fight against the Scaldi. Nothing, I thought, could match it. I was wrong. Like a falling star, he descended on the Tariff Crow, a castleen berserker, his sword biting and slashing like a silver snake. They fell before him, wounds bursting open in bright splashes of blood. Fell and died, still scrabbling for their spears. How many? 20, I had counted. Most fell to Jocelyn, save the two Mairead had slain. Not all. Nectina and her daughters, Breatha and Spale, they flung themselves into the fray with keen little daggers. 4, I think, died at their hands. Maybe 5 or 6. There were 2 that Hyacinth finished, drawing a boot knife, the Prince of Travellers. I, shaking, killed none. So it was that Drustin found us, the Kruach of Alba, woad-patterned arms splashed to the elbows with gore, his face grimly exultant, the brown horse lathered and blown. The victorious army plunged raggedly through the copse, shouting behind him. He drew up, looked at his mother and his living sisters, their similar faces telling the same grief, and Mairead, the youngest, her smile forevermore stilled.
"Ah, no, no!"
We gathered to one side, Jocelyn kneeling in castellane penance, Hyacinth with bowed head. Nectina rose, grave and sorrowing.
"The Culloch Godam has taken his due," she said quietly. "My son, who rules in Alba?"
Drustin turned his head. A chariot plunged toward him, Aemon's, his face streaked with dust and blood. Behind the chariot bounced a corpse, a large young man, red-haired, his dead face locked in a grimace, flesh abraded. Melkon.
"I do, mother," Drustin answered softly. "The usurper is dead."
"Slain by the Kruach's own hand,"
Aemon shouted, lashing his team closer. Then he saw and drew rein.
"Dr. Moore, no!"
"For every victory,"
Nectina whispered, her great dark eyes shining with the mother's tears, "there is a price."
Chapter 73. We did not ride into Bryn Garadam that day, but remained at the battle site. Our poets do not sing of the dire aftermath of war, of the horror and stench of it, strewn bodies, entrails spilled beneath the sun, and stinking, ravens plucking gobbets of flesh, the buzzing clouds of flies that gather, nor of mass graves, or the horrid effort of digging, warriors cursing flies and wiping the sweat from their brows. Some 1,200 of the Tariff Crow survived to surrender,
Thousands had been killed. It had been a slaughter when the Kulak Gorum had boiled over the edge of the valley. They'd been caught unprepared, on lower ground, by the very enemy they'd thought to surprise. Only Melkon's hostage-takers had succeeded at that, I thought, and they were all dead too. I worked as one with Nectina and her daughters, her surviving daughters, bearing water into the battlefield for the dying and the labouring alike. I came upon Jocelyn among the latter, working grimly. The dead of Drustin's army had been gathered, 800 or more, and a good many of them Dalriada. They were building a cairn above them, stone by heavy stone. He shook his head when I offered him the dipper. His face was haggard in its beauty, splashes of blood drying rust-brown and flaking on his skin, his clothing, even the thick wheat-blonde cable of his braid. Poets do not sing of that, either. "You did what you had to do," I said softly to him, proffering the dipper again. "Jocelyn, they drew to kill."
"I should have saved her, too," he replied grimly, turning away and hoisting another stone.
I let it be and moved on, offering my dipper to a Cruinia warrior who took it gratefully, gripping with both hands, throat working as he drank. And on and on. The dying were the worst. I remembered the night Guy was killed, pressing my hands over Alcuin's wound in Delaunay's courtyard, desperately trying to staunch the warm, slick flow of blood. I remembered Alcuin dying in Delaunay's library, his hand clenching hard on mine. I lived it over that day, many times. I wept for them all, Kulak Gorum and Tarb Crow alike, prolonging their lives with the cool water they craved, while the ravens waited to claim their due. We made camp there that night, 1,000 fires blazing. A great victory had been won. Drustin did not deny them that, their celebration, though Moraith lay on a bier in state. I heard the stories that night, from Quintilius Rouse, who came limping to the fire, eyes gleaming, a great swath of bandage about his head, and one tied about the calf of his left leg.
"Blessed Eloa, but it was something to see," he said, accepting a skin of wine with a sigh of relief. "Ah, Phaedra, they scattered before us, like autumn leaves before winter's wind. And Drustin, Eloa's balls, he went through them like a scythe, shouting for Melkon. Savages they are, but ah, Aemon and Gronya, oh, you should have seen it. The foot soldiers surrounded the chariots, and they tore into that valley like...
Words failed him, and he took a swig of wine, shaking his head.
"She was magnificent," he said. "But Aemon, he fought like a tiger, I don't mind telling you. Once that lad's made up his mind, there's no stopping him. But Drustin and Melkon, oh, that was a battle."
He told it for us then, how Melkon came riding amid the slaughter, tall and haughty atop his grey horse, how they fought, how Drustin prevailed, and how Aemon came to lash the usurper's corpse behind his chariot, Gronya his sister guarding him all the while, lashing her team so they raced in a circle about him. It was a splendid tale, valiant and heroic. 4 of his Dangeline sailors were dead.
"They knew, my lady," Quintilius Rouse said at last, catching my eye and hearing my silence.
When had I become my lady to him? I tried to remember, and could not.
"All those who sign on with me, you may believe it, know the risks. To die on land, it is a glorious thing. 'Tis the watery grave we fear."
He looked sidelong at me in the firelight and cleared his throat.
"I promised them somewhat."
"What?" He caught me wandering, I feared. "My Lord Admiral?" He cleared his throat again and scratched at his bandaged skull.
I promised they'd be knighted, those that lived, at your own hand."
Doubly unawares he'd caught me, I looked at him in surprise. "My hand?"
"You're the Queen's ambassador," he said gruffly. "They respect you, and you've the right."
"They do? I do?" On the far side of the fire, Jocelyn lifted his head.
"You do, Fedra."
It was the first he'd spoken since the cairn. I blinked at him. "If it is so, Jocelyn, then you..."
"No," his voice was harsh. "Not I. I am Carsiel's servant, and a poor one at that. But they deserve it."
I looked bewilderingly at Quintilius Rouse. "Let it be done, then, if they truly wish it at my hands. They've earned as much and more." The Admiral grinned and rose awkwardly, wounded leg stiff. With one hand he placed fingers to his lips and blew a piercing whistle. With the other he drew his sword and gave it unto me. It weighed more than I guessed, a curved blade, clean, but the grip still slick with the sweat of battle. I stood holding it, feeling like a child at a mask, while the Dangeline sailors filed one by one out of the darkness beyond the firelight. I did it then. Rouse supplied the words, and I repeated them. In Eloa's name and that of Isandra de la Courcelle, Queen of Terre d'Ange, I bequeathed the title of Chevalier on 20-odd Dangeline sailors, feeling all the while an impostor. But their eyes, as they knelt, said I was somewhat else.
"Well done," Quintilius Rouse exclaimed, reclaiming his sword and clapping me on the back when it was done. "I'll give them a fighting name, I will. Fedra's boys, I'll call this lot. Let 'em take pride in that."
"My lord," I said, not sure if I were laughing or weeping, "I wish you wouldn't." Somewhere beyond the fire, Jocelyn's eyes shone, red-rimmed with dire amusement and unshed tears.
"We are at war, little night-blooming flower," the Admiral said, his breath smelling of wine. "Or so you tell me. What did you expect? If they will fight for you, well and good. If they take pride in dying for your name, so much the better. What did you think when you bid me on this mission?"
"I don't know," I whispered, and buried my face in my hands. I saw in the darkness there Voldemar Selig and 20,000 Skaldi, the allies of Cumlach, glittering and fierce. It was not true. I had known. "Call them what you will." He did, too. The name still stands in the royal fleet. When Quintilius Rouse had departed, I sought out Hyacinth, who maintained an unspeaking vigil at Morave's bier.
"I heard," he said dully, sensing my approach. "Congratulations."
"Hyacinth," I said his name, once my signal, and touched his shoulder. "I never sought a claim for it. You know that." He heaved a sigh, shuddering all over, and his face took on an expression I recognized as human.
"I know," he said softly. "It is war. But our Eloa, Fedra, why? She was only a girl."
"You cared for her," I said the obvious.
"I cared for her," Hyacinth smiled painfully, faint and wry. "Yes, or I might have, at least. Waking Dreamer, that's what she named me, isn't it? She said it first, on the beach." Another profound shudder. I put my arms around him. His voice came muffled against my shoulder.
"My own people, they cast me out for it. You believed. I know it's true. You talked the Admiral into as much. But she was the first to touch me, to put a name to it, in welcome. Nectina's daughter."
Hyacinth wept. I wept. Both of us did. War is a strange thing. All that lay unspoken between us, unaddressed, set aside for this business of war.
"We are on a mission for the Queen. That above all else.
I knew it as well as he. And yet, when he turned his grief-stricken face to mine, I kissed him, lowering my lips to his. His arms caught at me like a drowning man's. At Balm House in the night court,
They say Nama lay with the king of Persis out of compassion, to heal the pain in his soul. I grew up in the night court. I knew such things. Yet never did I understand them until that night, when I drew Hyacinth out of the circle of torchlight that surrounded Mirraith's spear. We err, those of us who have quarrelled, fragmenting Nama's desire into 13 parts, 13 houses. There are many threads, it is true, but all of one piece, woven together like a mendicant's cloak. Comfort and atonement, sorrow and exhilaration, all of a piece, woven together on the green earth of Alba. The poets do not sing of this either, how death begets the urge toward life. I, who knew how to take pain, took Hyacinth's. Pain and delight I took from him, and gave him back both, until we understood, the both of us, how they are intertwined, how one does not come without the other. Friend, brother, lover, I shaped his face in darkness with my hands, his mouth with my lips, his body with my own. He cried out before the end. I had used somewhat of my art. "Shh," I whispered, stilling his cry with my fingertips, my own flesh sounding like a plucked harp string. "Shh." Until I die, I swear, I will never grasp the whole of what it is to serve Nama. Afterward he drew away, guilt coming in the ebb of desire. Hyacinth, I laid my cheek against his back, the warm brown skin, and put my arms around him. The draught of poppies takes away pain, that the body might sleep and heal. So Nama may send desire, that our hearts may forget for a time and heal. Is that somewhat else you were taught? He asked, the last word harsh. Yes, I said softly, by you. He looked around at me then, turning in the circle of my arms, touching my face and shaking his head. It wasn't supposed to be like this, Fedra, you and I, not like this. No. I smoothed his black ringlets, touched with silver by the faint starlight, and smiled ruefully. We were to be the Queen of Courtesans and the Prince of Travellers, ruling the city of Eloa from Mont Nui to the palace, not coupling on the sod of Alba near a blood-soaked battlefield, with 6,000 wild Cruinia and grief in attendance. But here we are. It made him smile too, a little bit. We should go back, he said, gazing toward the torches and the blazing fires. The Dalriada and Drustin's Cruinia celebrated still. Somewhere, penned together and under guard, the remnants of Melkon's army watched in sullen exhaustion. They'd buried their dead too, and a harder job it was, though no cairn marked their grave, for the dead were many, and the diggers few. Others had taken up the vigil at Mirraith's spear when we returned. Nectina and her daughters, who sang a morning song, quiet and beautiful, a woven thread of chant they passed among the three of them, taking it up in turn, descant and rise. I stood and listened for a time, tears in my eyes, both for its sorrow and its loveliness. And Jocelyn, who knelt in a private castellan prayer. He lifted his head at our approach, giving me a bleak stare. Never mind him, I thought, taking Hyacinth's face in both hands. I drew it down and placed a kiss on his brow. Grieve and be healed, I whispered. He nodded and took up his place. I too knelt, gazing at Mirraith, her face serene in death as it had been in life. Nectina, Breather, and Spale sang, weaving the threads of life together, victory and loss, birth and death, love and hatred. After a time, I dreamed a little, waking, as had not happened since I was a child in Sirius House, kneeling attendant for endless hours at some adult function. Another voice had joined theirs, deeper, sounding an earth-rooted refrain.
I shook myself alert and saw Drustin, who had joined his mother and sisters. "He is quite beautiful after all," I thought, surprised at the thought, seeing for the first time what Isandra had seen. His features beneath the tattooing were finely made, black hair falling straight and shining over his shoulders. Earth's oldest children. All of them sang together, poignantly lovely. "Barbarians, we call them." When it was done, Breather started another melody. This, though, only the women carried. Drustin made his way to Jocelyn, crouching at his side. I wondered if I should rise to translate, but the young Kruach of Alba spoke in broken Kedaki. "That I have not voiced even to you," he had said to me. I understood why, hearing it.
"You fight for family," he said to Jocelyn. "Brother."
Drustin held out his hand. Jocelyn shook his head, eyes on the bier.
"Your sister is dead, my king," he said in his flawless Kedaki, learned at his father's knee. "Do me no honor. I failed you."
Shifting, Drustin met my eyes and nodded. I rose smoothly and went to join them, kneeling and bowing my head.
"Thousands died this day, and I could not save them," Drustin said in Kruinya, looking at Jocelyn and not me. "I, born Kruach, to give my life for my people. Do you say right was not done this day, Prince of Swords?"
I translated it all, even the title. Jocelyn turned his gaze on Drustin.
"My king, it is your birthright you have taken, and the death of your kin you avenged. It was rightfully done. It is I who have failed in my trust."
I translated for Drustin, adding somewhat about Castline vows. The Kruach looked thoughtful and rubbed his misformed foot unselfconsciously, working at the cramped ligaments. Then he said,
"You have sworn no vow to the Kulluk Gorum. Our lives we risked to regain Alba. Do not demean my sister's death in taking it from her."
Jocelyn started at his words when I spoke them. I swear the arrogance of castlings, even outcasts, especially outcasts, is beyond my compass. It dawned on him, though, slow and gradual, that Drustin was telling him he was overstepping the bounds of his responsibility. And even more slowly, but it might be true. Having said his piece, Drustin merely continued to look evenly at Jocelyn, holding out his hand, blue-whirled and strong.
"Brother," Jocelyn said in Kerdiki, and clasped Drustin's hand, "if you will have me."
No need to translate that. Drustin understood and grinned, standing and pulling Jocelyn with him, embracing him.
"There you are," a woman's voice ran out in Erin. I looked up to see Gronya, Eamon a step behind her.
Not a cut on them, either one. It must be true that they fought like tigers. I didn't doubt it.
"Ah, little sister," Gronya said, sorrowing, gazing at Mairead.
Plucking a jeweled dagger from her kirtle, she seized a lock of her own red-gold hair, cutting it. Approaching the bier, she laid it carefully beneath Mairead's folded hands.
"We avenged you, little sister. Do not doubt it. 100 times over.
Eamon followed suit, his hair paler than his twins, still streaked with traces of lime. He touched Mairead's cold hands gently.
"Be at peace with it, little sister. We will sing of your valor."
"Folk need to see you," Gronya said to Drustin in her direct way, eyes on a level with his. "To share your grief, to share the victory. They followed the Kulluk Gorum and fought well for you this day." Drustin nodded.
"I will come."
"And you?" Gronya looked at me, still kneeling, and smiled. "You come as the Swan's emissary. You ask the Kulluk Gorum to follow you. They need to see."
"I'm coming," I said, and stood, small beside the twins.
Jocelyn gave his smooth, castline bow, not quite meeting my eyes. I glanced at Hyacinth.
Our eyes met in a small silence, the old familiarity and the new.
"I will stay," he said softly. "Let the dreamers and the seers keep watch. It is what we do."
Chapter 74. The next day we marched into Bryn Gorridum. It was a small city which surprised me. I recognized the underpinnings of Tiberian stonework. We intersected with a mighty river and marched along its banks toward a bay, for the city lay on the eastern shore of Alba. Common folk turned out and cheered. Melkon had not been loved. When we reached the fortress proper, we found the gates open and the door lowered. The garrison turned out to surrender arms. They had heard, and they gave us Folkladr, Melkon's mother. Later we learned that it was not only the defeat of Melkon's forces that put the fear of Kulluk Gorum into the followers of the Red Bull, but the numbers of common folk, especially within the fortress itself, servants who had escaped the slaughter of Melkon's betrayal, whose black eyes gleamed to hear the news of the Kruach's return. Discretion is the greater part of valor. The Tarab Crow surrendered. So it was that Drustin Mab Nectina took his throne. Down came the standard of the Red Bull. The black boar flew once more from the peaks of Bryn Gorridum. The Kruach's sister, Moraith, was buried in state. The head of Melkon the Usurper was nailed above the gates of Bryn Gorridum. Drustin had not spoken in jest. "We do not call them barbarians entirely without reason."
Seated on the throne, he heard Folkladr's petition. As a guest of honour, I was privileged to attend, a privilege I'd gladly have forgone. I stood watching. It seemed 1,000 years ago, but I had stood in the hall of audience where Lionette de Trevelyan stood trial, Alcuin and I straining to catch a glimpse of the proceedings. Now I stood at the left hand of the throne of Alba, my castellan companion attendant, struggling to keep my features expressionless as I represented the Queen of Terdange. If I had felt a fraud bestowing knighthood on Quintilius Rouse's men, it was nothing to this. I could not help but think, if Isandra de la Courcelle knew we would succeed thus far, she would never have chosen to send me. "A whore's unwanted get," I remembered the Dawain's voice echoing in my memory. But send me she had, and if I was a whore's unwanted get, I was Anafiel de Launay's chosen pupil too, and he had deemed me worthy of his name when my own parents sold my right to carry theirs. And this woman who stood before Drustin's throne, tall and unrepentant, had caused not only the bloodshed to which I'd borne witness yesterday, and that which had stained these halls, but the deaths I'd witnessed decreed that other day, when I stood on tiptoe in the hall of audience. Baudouin de Trevelyan, who'd given me my first kiss. He'd taken the luck of it with him. I'd been his parting gift. From Melisande, who brought to light letters written to Lionette de Trevelyan from this woman, who stood before Drustin's throne. The Tsingani are right. It is a long road. Drustin let her speak, and she spoke well, impassioned, of the passing of the old ways, of the need to join the new, where son succeeded father. No betrayal, but a noble cause, she said in ringing tones, to sweep away the cobwebs of superstition that said no one may know a child's father, to acknowledge the sovereignty of paternity. A tall woman, Folkladr, with red hair and the whirls of a Cruinia warrior tattooed on her cheeks. I heard later that she killed 4 men by her own hand when the garrison came for her. The lioness of Azal had been overpowering too, although she'd never held a sword. It had made Baudouin wild and daring and a little mad. I wondered if Melkon had been the same. It was a good speech, and there were men who would have listened, inspired to overturn the bonds of matrilinealism, to raise up the children of their blood and seed, making them heirs to all they owned
all they claimed. Not Earth's eldest children. Four sets of identical eyes watched as they listened. Drustan, Nectina, Braither, Spale. It should have been five. I wondered, did we follow the old ways once? Ella was wondering, put an end to it, if we did. Our bloodlines we traced through mother and father alike, back to the shining linkages of the past, to Eloa and his companions when they walked the earth, our lineage we bear stamped on our faces, in our souls. Isolated by the Master of the Straits, in Alba it is different. They trace heritage through the mother, beyond question, proof born in blood and tears. Nectina's children had different fathers, warriors, dreamers. Love as thou wilt. Blessed Eloa, too, was Earth's child. Her last begotten, conceived in her dark womb of blood and tears. Having listened, Drustan bent his head toward the twins at his right hand.
What say the Dalriada?
Aemon drew a deep breath.
Drustan, crew, you know our hearts and our minds. Your uncle was our friend. In Era we do not suffer a blood traitor to live.
Gronya nodded in accord, unwontedly sober. They keep the old ways too, I thought, remembering her son Brennan. Who was his father? I'd never asked. Eloa knew the next born might be Rouse's get. Drustan looked at me.
What says Terdange?
I hadn't been expecting it, though I don't know why. It is how such things are done, in the eyes of all assembled. I remembered Parliament